Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 62. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and it's great to have your company. Before we dive into this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast. I'm so grateful for your immense generosity. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. January's prize is a copy of The Falcon's Rise, a novel of Anne Boleyn by Natalia Richards. A huge thank you to the author for sponsoring this wonderful prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show today is Karen Fleming. Karen is a forensic artist based in Scotland. She mainly works with museums and archaeologists, creating facial reconstructions in both 2D and 3D from ancient skulls. Most notably, she has worked on medieval skulls excavated during renovation work at St Giles Cathedral in Edinburgh, in collaboration with the City Council. She studied painting at Edinburgh College of Art and has a Master of Science in Forensic Art and Facial Identification from the University of Dundee. Examples of her work can be found on her website, www.karenflemingforensicartist.com. My conversation with Karen straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Karen. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Lovely to have you on the show. Now, I thought we could begin by you introducing yourself to our listeners and just telling us a little bit about your background.
Well, I am a forensic artist and I'm based in Edinburgh, in Scotland. I have a degree from the University of Dundee in forensic art and facial identification. And before that, my background was as an artist, and I studied painting at Edinburgh College of Art.
Lovely. And can you tell us a little bit about the kind of work that a forensic artist does?
So a forensic artist can generally work in either law enforcement or in an archaeological setting, which is what I generally do. If it's used in forensic situations, especially archaeological, it's the only method that can be used in identifying somebody who is deceased, where sort of skeletal remains are the only evidence. There's sometimes a bit a need for artistic intervention to give people an idea of who the person was. And similarly, in law enforcement, it can be used to lead to the conviction of an offender, and obviously to recognise, say, a missing person, to give some closure to a family based on what remains have been found.
Okay, I actually came across your work recently, and it was in an article online, and it was all about these incredible facial reconstructions that you created of two people. It was a man and a woman who were buried at St Giles Cathedral in Edinburgh. And I believe that the man, what people thought was the 12th century, and that the woman was 16th century. Could you tell us a little bit about these individuals and how you got involved with this particular project?
Well, actually, the male reconstruction was done by my colleague, Kretzia, who's based in Italy, and he was from 12th century remains. Between us, we reconstructed 12 faces ranging from the 12th to the 15th, 16th century. Myself, I did the one that was in the press, the leper, was from 15th, 16th century. And we found there'd been an archaeological report done at the late 80s, early 90s, that obviously the experts, anthropologists, had aged and sexed the remains, and they knew by their burial what century they were from. The thing, Edinburgh City Council, who we collaborated with in the past, they've worked with graduates from the University of Dundee in the forensic art department, most recently on the first phase of the tram project, and they actually released a book with some faces and some sort of general history of who the people would have been. So it's quite a new thing doing this with Dundee University, but hopefully they're going to be able to do some more in the future.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. So why do you think personally that it's important to recreate the faces of people who lived, you know, so many hundreds of years ago?
I think it just gives us a vision into the past. And I think people want to know what their ancestors looked like. I don't know if for some reason people maybe think, oh, they're going to look totally different from us, you know, with the evolution. But in reality, people will look at them and think, oh, that looks like my granny, or, you know, they see a similarity in themselves, which gives them a better understanding of, as I say, their ancestor. And it actually helps us to imagine them more as living beings, living people.
Yeah, definitely connects us more, doesn't it? I think when I look at those reconstructions, I feel, quite a close connection with the person, which is great. Now, I imagine that the process of reconstructing, of doing these reconstructions is quite complicated, but would you be able just to give us a little bit of a kind of a snapshot of the steps involved?
Yeah, so when doing the 2D reconstruction, we're either going to do it front facing or profile. We don't always have the complete skull, so sometimes we've got to maybe say we haven't got like the mandible to the jaw. We'd maybe take that an image from a similar age bracket. For example, when Lucrezia did the man, she didn't have the jaw. That's why she put the beard on, so that it wouldn't draw attention away from the actual face, which was correct by putting on general jaw. So when we first get the skulls and we get as complete as possible, quite often using masking tape, because they're in bits, we photograph it alongside a forensic ruler, and then this image is loaded onto Photoshop and measured appropriately, ready to work on. And then I don't know if you've seen on 3D reconstructions, we have pegs or markers, as they're called, which are measured and created to represent tissue depths. So when the markers are added to various points of the skull, you get an idea of the face shape. But a lot of it's just observing the skull, which we're lucky enough to be able to handle. So we get an idea maybe how big the nose was and the shape, etc., before we use various scientific equations which can estimate length, width, etc., things like the nose. The one thing is your eye fissure is something that can be almost certain about, because the eyelids being a muscle, they have to be connected to this sort of bony part within the eye socket, and that's usually quite visible in most skulls. And then when we've done all these measurements with the tissue depth markers, etc., we have a database of facial images which we're constantly updating, and we take various parts of that and then we can sort of alter them to fit the skull. Due to the cost implications of DNA testing, it can't be done on every skull, so sort of hair and eye colour is just something that might have been common colouring for people from that time period where the remains were found. We have to maybe do a wee bit of research there.
And so you always handle the physical remains when you're doing these reconstruction?
Yeah, well, so far, yeah. But if we were doing like a 3D interpretation, what happens is the skull is CT scanned and then it's 3D printed. I don't know if you've seen what a 3D print's like now. They're just so accurate. And then we would work on that, obviously, so there's no damage done to the actual human remains.
That's amazing. Gosh. And how long does it take you, like, for example, a 2D facial reconstruction?
A 2D can take up to a week, depends on how many hours you're putting in. Sometimes the bit that takes longest is actually finding the correct sort of facial images to create, you know, the finished face, because everything has to be in proportion. Once you've got all your measurements taken, you know, it's quite straightforward, just time consuming and fiddly, you know, on Photoshop.
Yeah, and the 3D, I imagine, takes a little bit longer, does it?
Yeah, I mean, because what we do with a 3D is, as well as the tissue depth markers, we use what's called the Manchester method, and it's using the muscles as well to get, a face shape. So we have to build the muscle depth and then put the skin on.
What historical research? So you've said that you've obviously looked at some other sources to get a really accurate portrayal. So what research do you undertake when you're doing these reconstructions?
Well, the archaeologists and other sort of relevant specialists, like anthropologists, will have done most of the background information based on where the remains have been found. So they'll know the time period, and when they come to us, they've usually been sexed and aged. And then the thing that we would really do would, if it was just the head, you know, we'll research what would have been clothing of the day. And if, like, the leprosy lady, I would research disease and how it shows itself and how it presents itself on the face, just to get it as accurate as possible. So we had the archaeologist report, so that was something we just read before we go through it.
And when you're doing the 3D reconstructions, what sort of materials do you use?
Well, the most common material is a clay, but we can use wax, which was obviously a material that was really common for using anatomical sculptures and things in the past, and it's harder to work with. I made the mistake of doing a reconstruction in the summer last year, and we're not known for our hot summers.
No.
But it was really hot last year, and it was, you can imagine, wax was just melting everywhere. So I would probably recommend clay.
Okay, and what are some of the other, I know you've been involved in some other projects as well recently.
Well, I mentioned the tram project. I did a facial reconstruction from a female that was found in Leith in Edinburgh, where they're doing that part of the tram project. There was a huge excavations from what they found to have been a graveyard there. That was, I'd mentioned that previously. And I did a full 3D reconstruction in wax of a druid skull that was, well, they believed it to be druid, from Stornoway in the Outer Hebrides. And she was believed to be over 60 years old, which is incredibly old for that time. And she was wax, and that was, we named her Hilda. Yeah, that was the one that was just never again in wax. It probably took about four times as long to do it.
Yeah, I've seen a picture of that one. That's amazing as well, thinking of how long ago she lived. It's amazing. Some other ones that I've seen are sort of jumping to mind. So have you seen the reconstruction of Richard III, the 3D reconstruction of his, or Mary? I think there's one of Mary, Queen of Scots too, somewhere around there.
Generates huge interest from the public, and it's just unfortunate that a lot of it has to be funded. So, you know, we need to be paid, and if the funding's available, you know, it can't be done. But fingers crossed, people are starting to take it a bit more seriously, because I think people want a visual reference to the past rather than just reading screeds and screeds of text just to put it together.
You know, you've mentioned that it can take a week or a few weeks, pending what kind of reconstruction you're doing, and it's obviously a lot of work. So how do you feel when you get to that point where you're actually looking into the face of someone who lived so long ago and you know, someone who you've brought back to life?
Well, you definitely have a sense of achievement, and you sort of almost forget when you're physically holding the skull, and you're just, it's almost like just doing a piece of artwork, so you don't think about it. And then if you sort of sit back and think, well, this, I'm holding the skull of this somebody who's actually lived in the 12th century, it's quite remarkable. But in a way, you actually feel you get to know them. You just want them to have, you know, had a good life. In a way, what would have been quite a difficult time for a lot of people. And we're always very respectful to the remains. I think that's really important, no matter how old they are. You know, this was a person.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very true. Well, I think it's amazing the work that you do, Karen, and I look forward to seeing some of your future projects. Do you have anything lined up at the moment?
I'm hoping to just get some things in the next few months, but again, it's just getting in touch with people and seeing if they can raise funds or we can get some sort of funding applications in just to get it done. Again, on top of that, I would really like to be able to get them DNA tested, and so we can get more of an accurate idea of eye colour, hair colour, etc., because obviously that can make a real difference of how a person looks.
Absolutely. So you'd like to get the 12 skeletons that you worked on, or is this just for future cases, you mean?
I think there's going to be a lot more in Edinburgh with the second phase has just started of this CHAM project, and it's the area that's going through, there will be more human remains, undoubtedly.
All right. Well, at the end of the episodes, Karen, what I like to do is play a little game that I call 10 to go. So this is just 10 questions for us to get to know you a little bit better. So are you ready to do that?
Oh, I hope so.
I'm sure you'll be fine. So first one, name a book that's currently on your to-be-read list.
I'm a terrible person for finding books on serial killers.
Oh.
That's my favourite read, is sort of an old sort of cases of murder and things. So I need to actually look. I'm just trying to finish off a book at the moment. But yeah, I'm going to just have a good rummage. I can't think of anything off the top of my head at the moment, but it'll definitely be about some crime. Like
crime. You've mentioned you live in Scotland. So what's an inspirational place to visit that's close to you, close to your home?
I'm very lucky that I live in an area called Portobello, which is Edinburgh's seaside. So I've got the beach like 10 minutes. Not even 10 minutes walk away. There's obviously so much history in Edinburgh, but when you've been born and brought up in a place, you sort of get slightly fed up hearing the same sort of stories. So I would always recommend that maybe if somebody's coming over to look into more the sort of unknown histories of Edinburgh rather than just your Birkenhare and your grave robbing, although that's very interesting. And Surgeons Hall in Edinburgh is part of the Royal College of Physicians, and it's now like a museum. And it's only got lots of jars full of specimens. Not maybe good for somebody with a more sensitive stomach.
Yes.
But I need it.
Oh, I've been to Edinburgh only once, but it was amazing. Yeah. Absolutely amazing. And what's a new skill that you'd like to learn?
Taxidermy.
Oh,
just
okay.
Like that. I know it's hard to do it.
I can see a theme going on here with your reading and your skills. What was your first paid job?
Oh, I briefly worked in a baker's when I was 15. I didn't last long.
Early mornings?
it was a Saturday job, and I think it just wasn't for me. It was a long time ago.
And what do you do to unwind and relax?
I like to just sit with the family and watch Netflix or sort of good TV drama if I'm really relaxed. And I also just like to sort of socialise friends. As I say, I live in a area where there's some really nice walks. Edinburgh's good for that, as you'll know, that we've got parks everywhere, plenty outside space.
Fantastic. And do you have a favourite season?
Winter.
And I think I was going to ask you about something you love about where you live, but I think you've told us about lots of amazing things.
I love the weather when it's cold. As I say, it was a bit warm in the summer, but...
And well, that's good that you like cold weather. You'd get plenty of that, don't you?
Good climate, yeah.
And what's your favourite comfort food?
I do like sitting in and just having Chinese with, you know, just to unwind if we do not want to cook or anything, you know, we'll just order in Chinese takeaway. Although it's maybe, is that a comfort food?
Yeah, I'm sure it can be comfort food. If it comforts you, it's a comfort food. Do you have a period of history that you feel really drawn to, or do you just kind of like history in general?
I'm very interested in sort of social history. Not so distant history, although I'm obviously interested in archaeology, but I've got a real interest in, you know, more on how people lived rather than your sort of kings and queens.
Yeah, I find that fascinating too, actually. Yeah. I like to know everything about, you know, the nitty-gritty of everyday life. I want to know it all.
That's me.
All right, and lucky last, what's something that you're looking forward to this year?
Well, it'd be nice to get a holiday, I think.
Oh, that'd be nice. Do you have any plans?
I haven't as yet. I've got 20th wedding anniversary, believe it or not, coming up this year, so I might go away for that. We'll see.
And Karen, before I let you go, the very last thing that we do on Talking Tudors, we like to, I ask all my guests if they have what I call a Tudor takeaway. So that's just something for our listeners to go and have a look at after the episode. It could be a song to listen to, a book to read, a film to watch. Do you have a Tudor takeaway for us?
Or is it like it's not to do with Tudors?
Well, if you have if you have something to do with the Tudors, that would be great.
I've got to do with the Tudors. I could give you a fantastic book to anybody, and it's called All That Remains, A Life and Death, and it's by Sue Black, who I'm sure a lot of your listeners, Dame Sue Black, possibly heard of. So yeah, highly recommend that. It's an award-winning book. She is an amazing anthropologist.
That sounds amazing. I'm embarrassed to say I've never heard of it, so I'm going to go and have a look at it straight after this. All That Remains, is that right?
All That Remains, A Life and Death, and it's Sue Black.
Well, that's great. That's a wonderful takeaway. And Karen, thank you so much for taking the time out of your obviously busy day and busy schedule to talk with us. It's been really lovely.
Nice to talk to you as well.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as The Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.